supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Phil Murphy, a first-time elected official, takes the reins of a state still reeling from the highs and lows of the Christie administration. Murphy says highs are just what New Jersey needs, and he pushed for legalizing recreational marijuana during the race for governor. A heavily Democratic legislature could help him realize that goal quickly, though it's hard to tell just when shops would be able to start selling. WHYY's Phil Gregory reports.
Advocates are hoping the state legislature legalizes marijuana within 100 days after Murphy takes office in January. Senator Nick Scutari is the primary sponsor of the legalization bill.
If we're ready to do it within the first 100 days, we'll certainly do it. I hope no later than the summer break, which would be June 30th. So that's what we're looking at, sometime between the end of April and June.
Senate President Steve Sweeney supports the legalization effort, but Craig Coughlin, who will take over as Speaker of the State Assembly, has not indicated whether he favors it.
I want to make sure it makes sense. I think there, as with any bill that would create something new, I think the devil is really in the details. And I think we need to understand it in its totality. Even if we're going to do it, I want to make sure that the bill that we have is the right bill.
Not all lawmakers are on board with legalizing recreational marijuana. Senate Republican leader Tom Kaine opposes it.
I think the health effects are significant. And I think when you look at what is happening in Colorado and a couple other places, from a crime issue, from a health issue, and from a variety of other fronts, I think they are realizing that they've been going in the wrong direction.
Maine and Massachusetts are the only states on the East Coast with legalized recreational marijuana laws. It's also allowed in five other states and the District of Columbia. If New Jersey lawmakers pass a legalization bill, Scott Rutter, the president of the New Jersey Cannabis Business Association, says it'll take several months to develop regulations, license sellers, and grow the product.
We really are looking at early 2019 on a very aggressive schedule. But more than likely, mid-2019 is when you would see most of the retail sales coming online.
Senator Scutari says it might not take that long to start making legal pot available for adults that want it. He says the six facilities licensed to sell medical marijuana in New Jersey are underutilized.
If we might be able to allow them to temporarily fill in a little bit with respect to the legalized market, we could already start to drain people's interest in the black market and already start to early on see some benefit of the tax revenue. So that's something that's under consideration.
How many retail locations would eventually be authorized to sell marijuana? That's something Scutari is still examining.
I mean, when you think about liquor stores, there's one in just about, every neighborhood. So it may not be as many as that, but we certainly want to make there be enough widespread opportunity that people can get them, and then there'll be a greater job opportunity.
Advocates say marijuana use is already widespread, and making it legal in New Jersey would create tens of thousands of jobs and strengthen the state's economy. From the New Jersey desk, Phil Gregory, WHYY News.
Philadelphia's incoming district attorney Larry Krasner says he'll rein in the city's civil asset forfeiture program, whereby property of those suspected of drug crimes is apprehended pending charges and trial. Some 100 miles due west, York County, Pennsylvania, is also under scrutiny for excessive use of that avail. Ed Mahan researched and wrote extensively about the practice in the York Daily Record and joins me now on NewsWorks Tonight. Ed, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Philadelphia was in the practice of actually seizing homes. That's not the case in York County, but York County has an even greater rate of seizing automobiles than even Philadelphia.
Yeah, and so yeah, my colleague and I, Dylan Sigelbaum, we looked into about 425 cases from 1 year in York County, and then we looked at state attorney general's office reports. And we found that York County, some years, they took more vehicles than Philadelphia through forfeiture. And when you adjust for population, they were the leader in Pennsylvania for taking vehicles. And one of the reasons for that in our reporting we found is that while much of the focus is on drug dealers, you can go after the vehicles, houses, cash that's used to make drug transactions possible. But in York County, it was frequently used against people who weren't convicted or even accused of dealing drugs.
Ed, your work is not merely gleaned on studying numbers. There are also some first-person accounts of those who fell into this trap. What comes to mind for you?
I mean, there's the one case. There's this person, Robert Cummings. He had heroin on him. He wanted to buy more heroin, so he made a phone call, and it turned out it was a setup. And he got arrested at a gas station. They ended up taking a vehicle that his sister, prosecutor said, was driving at some point, and it was owned by his brother-in-law. It was owned by Robert Cummings' brother-in-law. And so she lost the vehicle for more than 2 years. And in that case, she was never charged with the crime. And prosecutors held on to the vehicle. And after a judge ruled against them multiple times, she said she still hadn't received the vehicle back. We reached out to the DA's office about that case, and they said they would reach out to her personally to let her know she could get the car back. So that was one of the cases of someone who there's no record of them ever being charged with a crime but losing property.
How is it substantiated that some who were never charged with a crime have had items taken from them?
I think the argument they make is that, you know, there's individual circumstances that could influence why they would go after someone who wasn't charged with a crime. And the DA's office didn't go into details about those situations.
What happens with the property, be it cash or cars or otherwise?
So in your county, they have two big drug task force auctions a year. They auction the vehicles off. They auction TVs. The bulk of that money goes to police departments to fund the York County Drug Task Force. A smaller amount goes to treatment.
So there seems to be a commingling of the criminal justice and civil asset forfeiture programs. And as such, what form do plea bargains tend to take?
And so one of the things we found in our reporting, looking through cases, is there would be stated in criminal plea bargains that as one of the conditions for the plea bargain would be that the person would agree to not fight civil asset forfeiture. And in some cases, it was explicit that it was part of the deal.
We've been focusing on this issue intermittently in Philadelphia for years, though I am not sure there is even now much public appetite for pressuring the criminal justice system or lawmakers to make real change in civil asset forfeiture. What is your sense with the York County community?
Yeah, so the Senator Mike Fulmer from Lebanon County, he's a Republican. He carries around a copy of the Pennsylvania and U.S. Constitution with him at all times. In 2015, he proposed changes, including requiring a criminal conviction for forfeiture. That was defeated in part because the Pennsylvania District Attorneys Association opposed it strongly. And then this year, he supported a sort of scaled back reform, which he called a great first step. Under this new system, there's a greater burden of proof for prosecutors, a greater legal standard to keep the items through forfeiture. Senator Fulmer, he actually represents parts of York County too. And what he has said is that, you know, passing this law with the cooperation of the District Attorneys Association, you know, he thinks that they established a relationship and sort of established trust that would let them possibly do more reforms going down the road. And so, I mean, I'm not sure if there is a huge appetite for change. I mean, we'll see what feedback continues to be from our coverage and from other as the new law gets rolled out as well.
Ed, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks very much for having me.
Moving up the blue route now, Pennsylvania's 11th congressional district underwent a transformation in 2011. The once compact northeastern district was stretched and pulled south and east. Traditional anchor cities, Scranton and Wilkes-Barre, were axed, and solid Republican areas to the south were folded in instead. It was a clear gerrymander that was nonetheless legal under state law. Now, the 11th reaches snake-like all the way down to south-central Pennsylvania, linking two very different regions of the Commonwealth. WHYY's Katie Meyer reports that 6 years after the reapportionment, it's still an uneasy marriage.
We're on a little wooden platform overlooking the wide expanse of Atlantic Carbon Group's Stockton mine, just outside of Hazleton in Luzerne County. Justin Emmershaw, a 26-year-old mine engineer, is explaining the operation.
This is actually the largest open pit coal mine in northeast PA that's mining five seams all in one pit.
That rumbling sound is coming from 500 feet below us as a 20-person crew moves tons of rock to pull anthracite coal out of the ground. This is the industry that defines Hazleton. For better or worse, Emmershaw says.
Well, there's not much around here. You have mining and you have some manufacturing. Aside from that, yeah, I think more jobs in the area would definitely be beneficial, no matter what they are, to help economic growth.
In fact, coal used to define the entire 11th Congressional, to the point where people sometimes just called it the Anthracite District. But drive about an hour and a half south along I-81 to the district's other end in Cumberland County, and it's clear that's not accurate anymore.
You got the coal region and you have this agricultural region down here in Carlisle, and our focus is on totally different things.
Wayne Shade is an attorney who's been practicing in Carlisle for 45 years. Historically, the economy has been farming-based, so now it's also home to burgeoning distribution and warehousing industries, plus the U.S. Army War College and Dickinson College. Pat Craig owns the gift shop across the street from Shade's law office in the downtown area, and as we talk, she's painting the exterior bright purple. She says it's not just that Carlisle and Hazleton are different. They feel totally unrelated to each other.
I've never actually been to Hazleton. I know my husband drives there for a construction job every now and then, but I just don't think of Hazleton one way or the other.
There are other differences, too. Where Lackawanna and Luzerne counties up north have seen their combined populations fall almost 30% since 1930, the South Central region is growing. Dauphin, Cumberland, and Perry counties have bigger populations than ever before. The median income in Luzerne County is also more than $15,000 less than Cumberland's. That all means a different set of economic priorities. So why stick the two areas together in the first place? The move is more or less rooted in incumbent protection. Through shuffling around safe GOP areas and sticking cities into Democratic districts, more seats got wider red margins. As long as district populations stay about equal, it's all legal. Unlike some other districts, the redesign of the 11th doesn't hugely affect political outcomes in the areas it covers. The Lackawanna region is solidly GOP, and Cumberland County has been represented by Republicans in Congress since the 1960s. That's not likely to change anytime soon. So it might seem, then, that longtime 11th District Representative Lou Barletta, a conservative Republican who made his name as a staunch illegal immigration opponent, is a good ideological fit. Barletta was born and raised in Hazleton and once served as the city's mayor. Jim Grohol, the third-generation owner of Jimmy's Quick Lunch on the city's main strip, can vouch for that.
He's been coming in the restaurant since he's a little boy. His parents have been in, and his parents and my parents were friends.
Grohol says he really likes being represented by a native son, but he resists the idea Barletta can't do just as good a job down in Carlisle. Gary Eichelberger, a Republican Cumberland County commissioner, agrees. Kind of. He says he doesn't have an issue with Barletta's politics or his attention to Carlisle, per se. But
it does come back to that question of how far away can you be and still truly be in contact, be in touch with those local communities and serve them accordingly.
He adds, Barletta is one person, and he's leaving his seat in 2019 as part of a run for U.S. Senate. His successor might not do as good a job representing the interests of all the corners of the district. Grohol concedes that point, too. And he says if Barletta's replacement is from farther away, it might feel a little off.
That would depend on if he got to know us. I mean, if he spent time up here, if he had an office up here, that would really help. That's yet to be seen, I would say.
Bob Curry is president of the Hazleton Integration Project, a nonprofit aimed at easing tension between longtime residents and the influx of Latino immigrants who have moved to the city in the last decade. He puts it more strongly.
I mean, I can tell you the people here would be, I think, really upset if we elect a representative who has not grown up with the issues that we face in northeastern Pennsylvania, is not familiar with our problems. It's almost a kind of taxation without representation, because you really don't have that local representative that is speaking your language, speaking your voice.
And unless state lawmakers make the 11th district more compact when they reshape the congressional map in 2021, it's likely there will always be one side of the sprawling district that feels it's getting the short end of the gerrymandering stick. Katie Meyer in Harrisburg.
On November 17, 1967, thousands of students rallied outside the old Board of Education building near Center City, Philadelphia. 50 years on, Philadelphians are still talking about that day. Some remember it for the protest itself and what the students demanded. Just as many recall it for how the police responded and the man in charge of that response. More from WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
On that day, in 1967, the students in Philadelphia's increasingly black school district wanted schools that reflected them. They called for African-American history courses and new dress codes that would allow them to wear dashikis. It all seemed to be going well until two busloads of police showed up.
They broke through the line of students, and the next thing I knew, I had, I guess, maybe six or eight police officers charging at me. And it wasn't the prettiest thing you've ever seen.
Kenneth Hurd was a student at Massbaum Technical High School and a budding political activist. Police said students instigated the confrontation. Students said the police came after them. What's clear is the clash led to 57 arrests and scores of injuries. The city's new police commissioner, Frank Rizzo, oversaw the operation.
And Rizzo said, get their asses.
Karen Asper Jordan was 19 years old at the time.
Now, whether he said other things, he's been known to say things.
Some people claim Rizzo said, quote, get their black asses. Whatever he uttered, Rizzo's response that day became a significant part of his legacy. To some, it drove home his law and order toughness. To others, it signified racial prejudice. For kids like Asper Jordan, who was dragged by police, the day became an indelible part of their memories.
And if you were abused in any way, you don't forget abuse. I don't care who does, you don't forget abuse.
Asper Jordan gathered with other activists over the weekend to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the protest. It was a well-timed celebration since Rizzo's legacy has been in the news. The city recently announced it would move a prominently placed statue of the former mayor, partly because of his legacy on race. But for Kenneth Hurd, the meaning of November 1967 is less about Rizzo and more about what officers did under his watch.
The brutality is one thing. It's the massiveness of the brutality. How do you do that to people? How do you stop a set of folk from doing it again?
That question rings as loud in 2017 as it did 50 years ago. Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
The search for planets beyond our solar system that could sustain life reveals a candidate a mere 11 light years away. Let's go sleuthing with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, we'll talk about the planet, although on second thought, 11 light years is still 11 light years.
Yeah, it is still 11 light years away. That's much further than we can get to in any reasonable amount of time with the kind of space transportation we have currently. Nonetheless, though, we've been able to detect quite a bit of information about this particular star and its planet that's looking very much like Earth, even if I say so myself. I'm not one to jump on the bandwagon immediately for every quote-unquote Earth-like candidate that shows up, which is quite frequently these days. But this one, this particular one, called Ross 128, seems to be much more like Earth, and fortunately, its star is a star that is benign enough to perhaps provide an environment where life could possibly develop.
What makes for a benign star?
In this case, it would have to be a star like our sun, in which the planet that we're speaking of is far enough away that the radiation bath that it gets is low enough that we can have an environment where life could develop. Now, this star is not a star like our sun. It is a red dwarf star. So it's much cooler in its temperature, and therefore the kind of radiation that it puts out is probably much safer than if it were a star like ours with a planet very close, or a class of star that was much more energetic.
But is Ross 128 close enough to derive warmth from this otherwise cooler star?
Well, as it turns out, it is close enough to not only derive enough warmth, but also to have a very short year. The year on this planet is only 9.9 days. However, its distance from the planet puts it firmly in what would be considered the habitable zone, that distance from the sun where a planet could have water existing as a liquid. And that then sets up the scenario of possibility for life to develop.
What is the state of our telescopic sleuthing that we could eventually make that sort of determination?
Unfortunately, we're still not at the point where we can directly, that is directly, image a planet orbiting another star. However, it looks like that possibility may dramatically increase in the future when we begin to bring online several, what we can now identify as giant ground-based telescopes. That's the Giant Magellan Telescope, 30-meter telescope, the European Extremely Large Telescope, that actually should be able to image Ross 128 once they come online in the not-too-distant future.
Families gathering during this Thanksgiving week provides a wonderful opportunity to work off turkey and fixins by going out of doors and seeing what's available in the night sky.
And in an effort to work off some of that turkey and stuffing, it might be the morning after Thanksgiving that you decide to take an early morning walk. If the sky is clear, you'll find over on the eastern horizon that Jupiter and Venus still dominate around 6 a.m. until sunrise. If you don't think you'll make it up that early, in the evening, you'll have a really wonderful crescent moon to keep an eye on through the week. But strictly speaking, Saturn and Mercury are still found very low in the southwestern sky after sunset, but you'll need a clear view of the horizon to catch them.
Derek, happy Thanksgiving to you and yours.
Same to you, David.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.